part of the intensity of her relief, she thought as she walked silently by his side, was the shock of a contrast. She had seen with the sudden, immediate vividness of sensory perception an exact picture of what the code of self-sacrifice would have meant if enacted by the three of them. Galt, giving up the woman he wanted for the sake of his friend, faking his greatest feeling out of existence and himself out of her life, no matter what the cost to him and to her, then dragging the rest of his years through the waste of the unreached and unfulfilled. She turning for consolation to a second choice, faking a love she did not feel, being willing to fake, since her will to self-deceit was the essential required for Galt's self-sacrifice, then living out her years in hopeless longing, accepting as relief for an unhealing wound some moments of weary affection, plus the tenet that love is futile and happiness is not to be found on earth. Francisco struggling in the elusive fog of a counterfeit reality, his life a fraud staged by the two who were dearest to him and most trusted, struggling to grasp what was missing from his happiness, struggling down the brittle scaffold of a lie over the abyss of the discovery that he was not the man she loved, but only a resented substitute, half-charity patient, half-crutch, his perceptiveness becoming his danger, and only his surrender to lethargic stupidity protecting the shoddy structure of his joy, struggling and giving up, and settling into the dreary routine of the conviction that fulfillment is impossible to man. The three of them, who had had all the gifts of existence spread out before them, ending up as embittered hulks, who cry in despair that life is frustration, the frustration of not being able to make unreality real. But this, she thought, was men's moral code in the outer world, a code that told them to act on the premise of one another's weakness, deceit, and stupidity. And this was the pattern of their lives. This struggle through a fog of the pretended and unacknowledged, this belief that facts are not solid or final, this state where denying any form to reality, men stumble through life, unreal and unformed, and die having never been born. Here, she thought, looking down through green branches at the glittering roofs of the valley, one dealt with men as clear and firm as sun and rocks, and the immense lightheartedness of her relief came from the knowledge that no battle was hard, no decision was dangerous, where there was no soggy uncertainty, no shapeless evasion to encounter. "Did it ever occur to you, Miss Taggart," said Galt in the casual tone of an abstract discussion, but as if he had known her thoughts, "that there is no conflict of interests among men, neither in business nor in trade, nor in their most personal desires, if they omit the irrational from their view of the possible, and destruction from their view of the practical? There is no conflict, and no call for sacrifice, and no man is a threat to the aims of another, if men understand that reality is an absolute not to be faked, that lies do not work, that the unearned cannot be had, that the undeserved cannot be given, that the destruction of a value which is will not bring value to that which isn't. The businessman who wishes to gain a market by throttling a superior competitor, the worker who wants a share of his employer's wealth, the artist who envies a rival's higher talent. They're all wishing facts out of existence, and destruction is the only means of their wish. If they pursue it, they will not achieve a market, a fortune, or an immortal fame. They will merely destroy production, employment, and art. A wish for the irrational is not to be achieved, whether the sacrificial victims are willing or not. But men will not cease to desire the impossible, and will not lose their longing to destroy, so long as self-destruction and self-sacrifice are preached to them as the practical means of achieving the happiness of the recipients. He glanced at her and added slowly, a slight emphasis as soul change in the impersonal tone of his voice, "No one's happiness but my own is in my power to achieve or to destroy. You should have had more respect for him and for me than to fear what you had feared." She did not answer. She felt as if a word would overfill the fullness of this moment. She merely turned to him with a look of acquiescence that was disarmed, childishly humble, and would have been an apology, but for its shining joy. He smiled in amusement, in understanding, almost in comradeship of the things they shared, and in sanction of the things she felt. They went on in silence, and it seemed to her that this was a summer day out of a carefree youth she had never lived. It was just a walk through the country by two people who were free for the pleasure of motion and sunlight, with no unsolved burdens left to carry. Her sense of lightness blended with the weightless sense of walking downhill, as if she needed no effort to walk, only to restrain herself from flying. And she walked, fighting the speed of the downward pull, her body leaning back, the wind blowing her skirt like a sail to break her motion. They parted at the bottom of the trail. He went to keep an appointment with Midas Mulligan, while she went to Hammond's Market with a list of items for the evening's dinner as the sole concern of her world. His wife, she thought, letting herself hear consciously the word Dr. Axton had not pronounced, the word she had long since felt but never named. For 3 weeks, she had been his wife, in every sense but one, and that final one was still to be earned. But this much was real, and today she could permit herself to know it, to feel it, to live with that one thought for this one day. The groceries, which Lawrence Hammond was lining up at her order, on the polished counter of his store, had never appeared to her as such shining objects, and intent upon them, she was only half conscious of some disturbing element, of something that was wrong, but that her mind was too full to notice. She noticed it only when she saw Hammond pause, frown, and stare upward, at the sky beyond his open storefront. In time with his words, "I think somebody's trying to repeat your stunt, Miss Taggart." She realized that it was the sound of an airplane overhead, and that it had been there for some time, a sound which was not to be heard in the valley after the first of this month. They rushed out to the street. The small silver cross of a plane was circling above the ring of mountains, like a sparkling dragonfly about to brush the peaks with its wings. "What does he think he's doing?" said Lawrence Hammond. There were people at the doors of the shops and standing still all down the street looking up. Is anyone expected?" she asked, and was astonished by the anxiety of her own voice. "No," said Hammond. "Everyone who's got any business here is here." He did not sound disturbed, but grimly curious. The plane was now a small dash, like a silver cigarette streaking against the flanks of the mountains. It had dropped lower. "Looks like a private monoplane," said Hammond, squinting against the sun. "Not an army model." "Will the ray screen hold out?" she asked tensely, in a tone of defensive resentment against the approach of an enemy. He chuckled. "Hold out? Will he see us?" "That screen is safer than an underground vault, Miss Taggart, as you ought to know." The plane rose, and for a moment it was only a bright speck like a bit of paper blown by the wind. It hovered uncertainly, then dropped down again into another circling spiral. "What in hell is he after?" said Hammond. Her eyes shot suddenly to his face. "He's looking for something," said Hammond. "What? Is there a telescope somewhere?" "Why, yes, at the airfield, but..." He was about to ask what was the matter with her voice, but she was running across the road down the path to the airfield, not knowing that she was running, driven by a reason she had no time and no courage to name. She found Dwight Sanders at the small telescope of the control tower. He was watching the plane attentively with a puzzled frown. "Let me see it," she snapped. She clutched the metal tube. She pressed her eye to the lens, her hand guiding the tube slowly to follow the plane. Then he saw that her hand had stopped. But her fingers did not open, and her face remained bent over the telescope pressed to the lens, until he looked closer and saw that the lens was pressed to her forehead. "What's the matter, Miss Taggart?" She raised her head slowly. "Is it anyone you know, Miss Taggart?" She did not answer. She hurried away, her steps rushing with the zigzagging aimlessness of uncertainty. She dared not run, but she had to escape, she had to hide. She did not know whether she was afraid to be seen by the men around her or by the plane above, the plane whose silver wings bore the number that belonged to Hank Reardon. She stopped when she stumbled over a rock and fell, and noticed that she had been running. She was on a small ledge in the cliffs above the airfield, hidden from the sight of the town, open to the view of the sky. She rose, her hands groping for support along a granite wall, feeling the warmth of the sun on the rock under her palms. She stood, her back pressed to the wall, unable to move or to take her eyes off the plane.